Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I'm Floodman11, and with me today I have Trevor Vasaurus. How are you today, Trevor Vasaurus?
Pretty good.
That's good.
It's looking good.
That's nice. That's good, man. That's real good.
Picking up.
And with us as well, we have a new member to Endurance Chat for the first time in any capacity. Welcome, Solheims.
Hello.
Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
So is that how you say your name? Is that correct?
Piamus, Hymus, whatever.
Cool.
It's Latin, so whatever.
Nice. So tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you from? How did you get into endurance racing?
I'm from Croatia, interestingly enough. I got into... It's like a quiz interview.
Yeah, basically.
I got into endurance racing sort of... I mean, I got into F1 to start with because that's the most popular bit of motorsport. And then I found out about this thing called endurance racing, and slowly over the years I've warmed up to it, and it's my primary drug now.
Hey, so... you'd be surprised how many people have that same story. I mean, for me, it took me many years, but I used to watch F1 as a really young kid. But now, yeah, same thing. I discovered endurance racing, and now that's my drug. So, yeah, a lot of people have that same thing. So, how long have you been watching endurance racing then?
On and off. Like, the first proper endurance race I watched was, terrifyingly enough, Le Mans 2013.
Nice.
Where Alan Simonson died.
Oh, not nice. Why'd you... Oh, yeah, no, I'm sad again.
Sorry. I'm very sorry. And sort of slowly warming up to it, watching the races on and off, and then when I saw the 2017 Bathurst 12 out, we're completely randomly stumbling onto it. I got into it and said, yeah, this is it.
What a good race to watch as well. What a good race to get hooked on. That Tony Vierlander stint in the middle was just like, damn.
Yeah.
So how long have you been around the sub then as well?
That's about as long as I've been around the sub, yeah.
Cool. That's good.
Since early 2017.
Nice. Well, it's great. Good to have you on, and hopefully this works out. I'm pretty sure it's going to work out. What do you reckon, Trevorsaurus? Do you reckon it's going to work out?
Yeah, why not?
Awesome. And also, because your name's so long, I'm just going to start calling you Trevor. I'm going to take a leaf out of Graham Goodwin's book.
I can handle it. It's all right.
Awesome. Well, let's go then, Sol and Trevor. Let's go. So we're going to wrap up in this episode. We're going to talk about the WC at Silverstone, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about the reveal of the Provisional World Endurance Championship 2019-2020 calendar. I had a bit of a go at it in the lead up to the Silverstone event, but we'll talk a bit more in depth about some of the other challenges that might come up. And then we'll jump into the ELMS at Silverstone as well, part of the doubleheader, before looking forward to the next group of endurance racing rounds coming up later on in September and in early October. So, firstly, WEC at Silverstone. This is round 3 of the World Endurance Championship Super Season. On the whole, how did we feel about the event? Let's go with Trevor first.
Well, it's the third WEC event that I've been to, and it was completely different to the previous two being Le Mans, where it's pretty uptight on accessibility of certain areas. But yeah, it was amazing. We started the race in the wing looking over the Rebellion pit lane, pit box.
Nice.
And an equivalent ticket for Formula One for that area would be several orders of magnitude more expensive.
Really?
To say the least.
Damn.
Yeah.
Just quickly, I completely forgot that you went to Silverstone. So yeah, let's do this. Let's share Trevorsaurus's Silverstone adventure. So where'd you go after the wing then? Or how long did you stay in the wing?
So let's start off with we decided to take some bikes along.
Okay.
To get around the circuit. And so I went with a mate of mine, and we started off in going around the paddock, having a look around the areas in the wing. That's the big jagged building with the pit lane underneath, and having a look at the pit lane activities before the race, having a look at the pit straight sort of entertainment. And
oh, did you see the hoverboard guy, dude? That guy?
Oh, yeah.
That was
pretty loud. And then the start of the race, started there, went around to the first corner, and then went all pretty much all the way around the circuit. It was, yeah, you could see the cars from each corner, and thankfully we had a nice duration of 6 hours to see it from.
And a beautiful English summer's day that actually had sun for a change.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then a little competition that happened to be won. So we got to visit the M-Tech garage, the BMW garage, mid-race.
Nice!
Which was a really, really nice experience. We got a little tour around the trucks. We weren't allowed inside the driver's areas, but the look around the tyre ovens, the tyres being prepped, look at the spares, all the spares of the bodywork, all kept together in neat piles, and then went around the inside the garage behind, looking at all the mechanics doing their work and the engineers looking at their screens and all that, the streams of numbers like the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly,
yeah, didn't you screens get kicked out? Of,
well, we then mid sentence there was just tons of Germans screaming Achtung. And then we were
the
kicked
yeah.
out. Yeah, that was when the one of the cars crapped its pants. And yeah, we were kicked out pretty quick.
Yeah, you were kicked out because you wouldn't have fit in the garage next to the car.
Yeah, because the car would have taken up the entire space in the garage.
There you go.
That sounds really cool. That's really awesome. And that was, of course, like the day after that they'd done the AMA with us as well. So did you say that you were from Reddit and you were like, hey, thanks for doing that?
So the gentleman that was running the AMA was also in the garage at the same time.
Oh, nice.
And so had a little chat, and they were really happy about the interaction between the drivers. So their whole spiel was that with motorsports, you can't see the athletes at work because they've got helmets on and they're within the car.
Yep.
Whereas with football, you have that sort of you don't have those barriers in place. So to have these extra ways to interact with the drivers, then they want to see that, and we see that as a positive.
Nice.
So they were happy with that feedback.
Cool. I'm glad. That's really, really, really good to hear for like a whole community basis. So you had a good weekend.
And then. Yep. And then one last thing.
Yep.
I did ask about the Big Beamer memes, and they're fed up.
Really?
I've had enough. Yep.
Whoops. Whoops. Sorry.
I don't think we're going to let it go, are we?
I think this is just going to add fuel to the fire. Oh, what have we done? What have we done? Okay. So it was a good weekend then. Really good weekend.
Amazing. Really, really good.
Awesome. Now, okay, how did we feel about the action on track in comparison? Did that live up to the hype, Sol, do you reckon?
I think the race was generally okay. Like, the major story of the entire race was, before the race, it was the EOT and BOP changes for LMP1 and GT Pro, respectively. And that was the main story before the race. During the race, the main story was, oh, this is not working out.
Yeah, you can say that.
And after the race, yeah, we know the big story.
Yeah, I gotta say, it does kind of make things a bit more difficult to watch in the interim with such little interest at the front. But I guess on the flip side, we do have the classes like GTE and LMP2 and GTEM really pulling up the mantle, especially GTEM. GTEM during this race was an absolutely stellar competition, and more people need to be paying attention to GTEM, and also the broadcasters need to be paying more attention to GTEM, because GTEM was fantastic. But let's start, I think we should start from the top. So we should talk about LMP1, and we can't really talk about LMP1 without talking about the first corner, can we?
Yeah. So the first corner, the number 3 Rebellion came into contact with the number 17 SMB, spun around, also tagged the number 10 Dragon Speed, and both the number 3 and the number 1 ended up off track. Now, looking at that replay, looking at the replay of the start from above, there does seem to be bluish smoke or dust coming from the coming from under the number three rebellion, which to me, so to me, it looks like it just bottomed out and lost all of its downforce from the floor and just understeered into the 17. Could the 17 have left more space? Possibly, but you like their racing drivers, they're gonna just exploit everything they can. So the 17 just left all the space. Was it Sarazan standing in the car?
I think it was Sarazan standing in the car, but he ended up getting a penalty for it as well, for basically closing the door. And it's one of those things where, you know, if you're wearing a blue hat, you're like, oh, I'm just taking the racing line. If you're wearing a red hat, you're like, oh, it's closed the door on me. So it's a bit one of those, you know, I would have honestly let it go as a racing incident, because in the end, both cars were severely disadvantaged, and then to try and affix blame to something like that is just a bit difficult. But yeah, as a result, in the end, the 17 car copped a penalty and yeah, dropped it back to the tail of the field, even behind the bicolors.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's commendable.
Yeah. Right. But what we did end up seeing though in LMP1 was we saw what we were expecting. Basically, the Toyotas shot away at the front of the field. Jensen Button even said before the race, it's like it's just going to be a Toyota fest. They ended up winning the race by 4 laps. The closest challenger really was in the early stages the number 11 SMP, which expired less than a stint into the race, which was really, really crap to see. It made me real sad because they were doing so well, and Elation just needs. He just needs a break, man. He just needs something good to go his way.
Sorry for the tangent out of Juris Racing. Wasn't Elation had a crazy accident at Indianapolis last year? Was it him? I don't think it was.
I'm not sure if that was. Not sure if I don't really follow Indy that much. It kind of muted that sort of kerfuffle at the start. Really muted what was going to be a really interesting battle between the two privateer teams, because we'd saw earlier in the weekend the SMP cars, at least on a 1 lap pace, seem to have the business in terms of trying to get that second, well, the top of the privateers. But in the end, yeah, it just kind of all fell apart, and the rebellions were just able to ease away from the, especially considering the other S&P car had the penalty in the spin. So yeah, it was a little disappointing to see that. Do you guys think that the hierarchy is still in the same order? Do you think it's still rebellion versus rebellion over S&P, or does the S&P have a car that can contend later on in the season?
On 1 lap pace, the S&P is much better. It's got the edge at least, but then based on race pace, the Rebellion R13s had an edge.
So what do you think that comes down to?
Well, the drivers did claim to have a problem with the R13s on the surface of the racetrack. And also, after the rebuild of the number one car, after the crash with Bruno Senna.
Oh, yeah, of course, with Bruno Senna, yep.
They were claiming it was very difficult to drive and unpredictable. So you could say that the qualifying session was just pure practice, still getting the setup tuned, rather than going out for a really competitive lap time.
That's a good call. Yeah. Go ahead, Sol.
Yeah, I think it may also come down to experience. Rebellion have been doing this for a while, and they've been LMP1, then LMP2, then now they're back in LMP1. So they're a bit of an experienced team, whereas S&P are new in this. So
yeah, and S&P are only going to get better over time as well, and especially in that BR1 engineering, or that BR1 car. I'm really impressed how it's come along, and I wouldn't be surprised if they do end up taking it properly to the rebellions later on the season, because like maybe somewhere like Sebring, where it's a lot more like there's just bumps everywhere and it's going to be a lot more difficult to set up a car for it, maybe the high downforce package of the SMP car will have that little bit of an edge. Because yeah, we saw onboard, I think there was an onboard of Jensen Button, and it was just like bump city, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's on the WEC YouTube channel.
Yeah, so. And you can find that one on the WEC YouTube channel. Well, let's look at some of the other stories in LMP1 before we get to the big news. Dragon Speed had a trying time. They ended up 28 laps down on the winner. They were in the pits for a long time with a gearbox issue, I think. Is that correct? Or something like that. It was a floor issue, actually. So another car that was a victim of the bumps at Silverstone. And then in true bi-collars fashion, they had an incident themselves, entirely by themselves. Now, Sol, you wanted to talk about this, so take us through it. What happened?
Yes. So the number 70 car, maybe flustered by the start, maybe it was Yegor Rujov just having a torrid race. Crashed with the number 71 Ferrari, which then shed bodywork everywhere. That caused a full course yellow, and Renny Binder, who was driving the number 4 by collars at the time, got, shall we say, caught out.
A little bit. Apparently, he didn't have a radio contact at the time, so I guess you can understand why he would have been a bit caught out, but basically he came up to behind a GT car and an LMP car who were slowing for full course yellow and didn't realize it and slammed on the brakes and then found the same patch of dirt that Kimi Raikkonen found in 2014. Yeah, and so, yeah, a truly bi-collars way to throw away any sort of result. Like, I swear, you think of it, the most ridiculous ways that a car can fail a race and the bi-collars car will go out and do it every single time.
Bi-collars Racing, sponsored by Murphy.
Yeah, Mr. Murphy, Murphy's Law. But of course, the big news to come out of the LMP1 class out of Silverstone was the fact that the winning and second place Toyota cars had both been disqualified for floor deflection violations. So basically, the plank that the entire car sits on, that holds the car together underneath, was deflecting more than the allowed limits. Now, there's been a few theories as to why this was the case, but the most prevailing theory is the bumps, of course. Silverstone underwent a substantial repaving over the past year, and there has been numerous responses to say that it was a bit crap. There's a lot of bumps everywhere, and it wasn't really the par of a Formula One standard or great FIA Grade 1 standard resurfacing. Now, Toyota, of course, didn't actually need to go as hard as they did. They ended up winning by 4 laps, which was a mental margin in itself. But as it happened, it sounds like what they've said is that the constant attack of the bumps on the floor of the car actually weakened the integrity of the plank and thus made it fail the floor deflection test. So what we got in the end was the first non-hybrid victory in the WEC ever. Woo!
Well, that's Toyota's point of view. Another point of view is you race on the circuit that is presented in front of you, and they completely failed that.
Yeah.
That's their job is to set up the car based on the practice sessions and looking at the wear rate of the skid block, and they completely failed in that remark.
Yep. That's also a good interpretation of it. And
that,
you know, they came out afterwards and said, like, yeah, we messed up. We're not going to contest it. It's fine. But, like, it's just like, guys, you have literally zero competition. Why are you pushing so hard? Why are you making these mistakes? Because you wouldn't see Porsche do something like this. Or you wouldn't see Audi do something like this.
I think that their miscalculation may have something to do that in the race, they have to go offline a lot more than they do in practice and qualifying, because they have to contend with traffic a lot more. Because in the race, there's pretty much always 30-ish cars on track, which is not the case in practice and qualifying. So if the bumps are worse offline, and there's also the curbs, and we've seen Fernando Alonso go very aggressive offline to lap traffic in Stowe, I believe, in Stowe Corner. Yep.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Not something I'd considered.
Yeah, they're going offline a lot more in the race. Might have something to do with their eventual disqualification. Now, essentially, the main cause of the immediate cause of the skid blocks being deflecting too much, i.e. being too worn down, is ride height being too low, as I understand it. Is it?
That would be some part of it, yeah. So basically, they're just pushing too hard, and I guess the sort of thing that I've heard through other media outlets and stuff like that is the fact that they're running as if they're racing a Phantom Porsche, which, okay, yeah, that's fine, but it's in like, well, why would you even bother then? You're basically running against an imaginary competition, so why even bother going to that extent? So it just calls into the question again, why are they doing this again and again and again? But in the end, though, they got disqualified, means 0 points. Rebellion get a 1-2 finish. S&P end up on the podium. That's all well and good, but it does again hide the fact that they're just much, much better than the privateers. And this supposed equivalence of technology that we've been talking about is entirely false.
A massive failure.
Yeah, exactly.
A massive failure. So Porsche announced they were pulling out of LMP1 in July 2017. I think the fact that we've got any form of LMP1 with more than two cars is, well, more than three cars, because I don't think my cars were ever going to leave. But yeah, I think that the fact we've even got LMP1 with eight cars or 10 cars at Le Mans is a good thing. But yeah, we did want more equivalence of technology. But as we found out, the privateers are using the same tires as Toyota, and they're not putting 500 horsepower through them at the front, and they're not putting only 500 horsepower at the back, they're putting a lot more. So they can't heat the fronts up, and they overhear the rears.
But we did hear today, to those who are listening on the day of recording of this, to the Graham Goodwin, Marshall Pruitt, This Week in Sports Cars podcast, that as of yet, an unannounced tire manufacturer is looking to enter LMP1. So we could actually see bespoke privateer LMP1 tires, which would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Three races too late, but yeah.
I mean, that's one of the compromises, but whatever. So yeah, in the end, as I mentioned, Rebellion won 2, so the Besh Laurent Menezes car took the win from Yanni and Lotterer. Of course, Bruno Senna breaking his ankle in a crash in the practice session on the Friday for the number 1 car. And the number 17 car of Sarrazin and Irujadev taking home third place. The number 10 car then ends up with a fourth place finish. So props to them for hanging on in there when the other cars have fallen away. So that kind of wraps up LMP1. Apparently the championship is super duper close now at the top. I mean, yeah. If you want to pay attention to the championship, you can. I don't really see the point, because it's just going to be a Toyota walkover for the rest of the season, yeah. But whatever.
I'd just like to make another point that LMP1 in this race really was like the spirit of endurance racing all the way. So the number 3 car was facing the wrong way in turn 1, ended up winning the race. The number 10 spent hours in the pits and ended up in 4th. So there you go.
There you go. Next up, LMP2. And the thing that really struck me about LMP2 is, where the heck did JCDC get all their pace from? They were unstoppable. Absolutely unstoppable. I was floored. I was absolutely floored. Trevorosaurus, please shed some light on any of this, if you have any data, because I've seen many a graph from you over the week.
So at the start of the race, we were standing on above the pit lane, and we could see the pace from the Malaysian JCDC car straight away. It was pulling away from the Team Nederland car in second place, and then the number 38 JCDC car was in third, I believe, at the start of the race.
Yep.
And it managed to get a really, really big gap. And then when the Michelin tyres of the Team Nederland car started to fall off, there was, yeah, then it was the 1-2 at the front.
And then they never really got challenged. They just completely walked away. It was literally JCDC 1-2 within 2 seconds. And then 2 laps to the next car, which was the Signatec Alpine car. And it's honestly, it was astounding to me, because in those JCDC cars, there are no platinum drivers. It's all gold and silver drivers. In fact, the number 37 car, the Malaysian car, has 1 gold driver and 2 silver drivers. How the hell did they pull 2 laps on the field with, you know, where other drivers are like Nico Lapierre and Andre Nogal and Alex Davison and Guido van der Garde, and like how did they do that?
Well, do we have another Pizzatola on our hands?
I honestly haven't looked too far in the data to find it, but I don't know. I honestly can't wrap my head around it, and it was distressing me all weekend because it didn't seem possible. It honestly just didn't seem possible. I'd love to see some data. If one of you listening out there is able to shed some light on how the JCDC cars were just so good, if that's a driver thing or a tire thing or a car thing, well, I mean, I guess because it's Yota Sport and this is their home track, I guess they might have had just mountains of data to go through, but like, I still can't wrap my head around it.
Well, I'll have a look into the numbers and do some crunching and maybe follow up in the thread when this is released.
Please do, because I'd love an answer. On the other hand, I was very, very disappointed that TDS had another shocking race with another problem, which just, it makes me so sad. I'd love Mateo Vaxivier to do well. I love Loic de Vaux to do well, because they're just two very good drivers that deserve better. And they ended up finishing 12 laps off the lead in last place in class, which...
And I picked them for my fantasy.
I know, they were such a bargain. It was just like, please just do well for everyone involved. But no, no, they didn't. Makes me sad. Any other things from LMP2? LMP2 had a pretty quiet race from all results. Unless you were looking deep into the tyre data, or do you want to save that for the LMS?
No, this is for both, applicable for both. So I'll just paste this into our group chat, and it shows with the Racing Team Nederland tyre stint lap times how they significantly per tyre, assuming they're doing two stints on each set of tyres, significantly drops off in pace versus the black JCDC data points, which have a much more horizontal shape to them. So they're effectively holding their pace based on number of laps completed, and they are on the Dunlop tyre.
Well, the Dunlop tyre has been the class of the LMP2 field for quite a long time, though, hasn't it? I honestly can't remember the last car on Michelin's to be properly competitive. Can you?
Well, also on this graph is the Dragon Speed LMP2 car, and this is also on Michelin's, but managed to have a very consistent lap time during its stint. And this made me wonder, and I haven't found any information on this, but if there was any pre-season testing done by Michelin on an LMP2 chassis, if it was done on the Orica 07 chassis rather than a Livier or a Dallara.
That's a very interesting thing, yeah.
Because then backs up why the Orica teams are doing much better on the Michelin tyre. I mean, you look at ELMS, Duquesne Engineering, they can manage to keep the pace high throughout the whole race, but they're also on Michelin tyres. But because that might be because they're on an Orica 07 chassis. And that might be a property of the Orica 07 chassis compared to the other two, or it could be the property of the tyre.
That's a very interesting point.
Could it be the setup, maybe? Could it be maybe just the setup differences? But that seems to trivialize, I should suppose, because they probably have enough practice before the race to figure out, okay, we're wearing tyres too much. We're gonna go with a more conservative setup.
I'd like to have more data in terms of more instances of each tyre and chassis combination. Unfortunately, we only have one Dallara in WEC LMP2 and the same with Ligier, and they're both on Michelin tyres. If we had multiple of different combinations, then that would help out a lot. Yeah.
There are one or two Dallaras in the ELMS on the Dunlop, so that could be another point if you wanted to delve in further. And if you guys haven't seen Trevorosaurus's blog posts or his blog in general, you should definitely check it out because it had a lot of really, really good stuff regarding aerodynamics and tire data, which we will delve into a little bit here. But yeah, check it out. It's Sports Car Engineering on Twitter and on Blogspot. Is that right?
That's correct, yep.
Yeah, so check it out. He's doing good stuff. And I love people doing original content. It's fantastic. It really helps the community as a whole understand what's going on. It's a very special thing.
And LMP2 did have a generally very quiet race with what with JCDC pulling two laps on the field, except for lap one when the 31 Dragon Speed, the car, which was later driven by Pastor Maldonado, didn't give Maldonado a chance to Maldonado.
Hey, because they almost ran into the back of a spinning car, didn't they?
I think that was not the case. I think it was the case that the car just sort of decided, no, we're not doing this. So it went into limp mode.
That's right.
It went into limp mode in turn two or three or four. So like on the in the first sector, it went into limp
the
mode,
loop, yeah,
and caused a massive GT traffic jam.
Good times. I was actually expecting a bit more from that car over the weekend, especially with the addition of Davison, and it kind of ended up where it normally would. So yeah, it was a bit disappointing from that. But anyway, JCDC won 2:38 from the 37, 2 seconds at the head of the field, and then two laps to the 36 car. I still can't wrap my head around it. If you have an answer, please let me know, because I am pulling my hair out as to where the JCDC cars got their pace, because it just seems unfathomable.
I have a solution.
What's the solution?
Bring G-Drive to WC.
Please no. We'll talk about that a bit more when we talk about the ELMS. Yeah. Moving on now to the GT classes, GTE Pro to start off with. And it was a pretty tit-for-tat race up the front between the AF Corsa 51, the 91 Porsche 911, and the 67 Ford Chip Ganassi Ford GT. But it was a race to forget for the Aston Martins and the BMWs. I mean, we've said this at Spa, and we said it for a little bit at Le Mans, but I really thought that the BMWs especially would have been a bit more on the pace, because they seem to be definitely on the pace in IMSA, and it looks like the things are slowly being put into place, but it just really wasn't the case. And again, I picked the 82 for my fantasy, and it was just a bad time, just a bad decision.
Well, the Aston Martins, they had a massive BOP increase.
It was monstrous, wasn't it?
Well, it was like very, very, kilos? Very significant.
Mm.
Yeah, and they were faster, but they were faster than they were before, but they weren't faster than the cars in the class, but they were just fast enough to block them from overtaking. So at the start of the race, they were holding them up for so long, about an hour.
Mm.
And that gave the Porsche head a big break.
Yeah, I think it was Maxime Martin, the car at the time, that was just able to just hold on at the very, very limit. And it turned into a GTE Pro train. It was just like Aston, BMW, Porsche, Ferrari, Ford, Porsche, the other BMW and the other Ferrari. It was just like a big train for the first third of the race until, you know, the cork in the bottle came out and everyone managed to file past. But to me, this sort of spells another missed opportunity for the Porsches, because as you said, they had that massive break at the front of the class, and they didn't convert it to a victory. They still haven't won, besides the Le Mans race. They still haven't won the WEC in the GTE Pro class with this Porsche yet. And it's really, really annoying that they haven't, because they keep making strategical errors that cost them victories. They keep getting into
and
good positions.
Errors.
Yeah, and they just can't close the deal. You gotta close the deal!
Both Porsches seem to have probably had setup issues for the entire race, because the 92 as we know, ran out of tyres, effectively.
In the first stint, yeah. I wonder if they didn't change tyres after qualifying or even during qualifying, because it seemed that they ran out of tyres much, much quicker than everyone else in that first stint. So I wonder if they didn't change tyres in qualifying and ran the same tyres through quali, both laps in quali and then two stints in the race. On top of that, I think they might have, you know, done something wrong with the setup as well in terms of the tire pressures, because yeah, they just didn't have any tire left at the first stint. But on top of that, of course, the number 91 car actually got disqualified post-race for a ride height infringement, which further compounds the you got to close the deal sort of thing with this car and with this class. And it's just, as a Porsche fan, it's becoming a pain in the butt.
Yeah, and half an hour ago or so, when we were talking about LMP1, you said you wouldn't see Porsche doing this. Like, but, you wouldn't see Porsche doing this.
But they did.
Yeah, they did. But in fairness, Porsche that didn't have to race anyone probably wouldn't make those errors and would correct for the fact, yes, we have a massive advantage. In the age of BOP GT, they might have to push the car and either run out of tires or run out of skid lock.
And it was a really good battle towards the end of GTE Pro as well. I mean, you had the 51 kind of holding off the charge of the Porsche, and then a bit further back you had the Chip Ganassi car fighting the other Porsche. And so it was just a really cool battle. And then, yeah, as we mentioned, with the Porsche getting disqualified, it was just kind of not great. The other stories in the GTE Pro class, we mentioned the AF Corsa 71 car with the puncture that really dropped them out of a really good position. The 66 yeah. car, did the door fall off again? I feel like the door fell off again.
The front fell off.
No, it's the door. The door fell off. I think they had another yeah. door problem, which you just keep seeing with the Ford GT, which is really dumb. We also mentioned yeah. the BMW forcing Trevor to evacuate the pits, which wasn't great. And yeah, it ended up being a sort of, I wouldn't say a cruisy win for AF Corsa, but it looked a lot easier on paper than it was on the track, I think. And still, James Collado found a reason to complain about BOP.
Yeah, I was going to say.
How does he do that? It's like he wins the race and still, oh no, the BOP is wrong.
I mean, he didn't land the field. It's not good enough.
Oh, it's so annoying. I actually really like GTE. I actually really like the GTE race at Silverstone. It was quite good.
Yeah, usually we rave about GT Pro, which is sort of the amazing race, and the pro drivers are so competitive, which they are, and both at Le Mans, well, not so much at Le Mans this year, but Le Mans last year, and the Spa 24 Hours and the Nürburgring 24, both of which are GT races primarily, we rave about the pro drivers and how they're competitive, but the more interesting GT class at Silverstone was GTM.
Definitely. I was just about to lead into that. The fact that we had, I think, four drivers in the middle of the race all setting laps in the 2 minutes flat within 10 seconds of each other on track was one of the coolest passages of the race I think I've ever seen in any class. And it was just, yeah. It was just absolutely fire. The GTEM class has really been revived this year with the new 911 and the new Ferrari. To see nine entrants after we had five last year, and people were talking about killing the class entirely, but now to see nine entrants and such a quality field, it's so cool. And we're getting rewarded with such a great exhibition of pro-am racing in GTEM that's been really, really good to see. So where should we start? There's so much to talk about. Where should we start?
Probably in qualifying, with the 56 being putting caution ahead of pace and sort of becoming the story of the little team that could.
Yeah, right. Team Project One. Who would have thought that this tiny team that won the was this the one that won the GT3 Le Mans Cup? I feel like it was. Might have been, no, that was EBI Motors, sorry. But yeah, either way, Team Project One, first year in the WEC, basically out of nowhere, and how did they put that on pole position? I still don't know. I talked about it a bit in the last episode, the episode 17.5, my Silverstone preview.
The solo.
Yeah, the solo one that I did. But the fact that they managed to do that and then really show up in the race as well was really, really cool. So props to them. But I still think at the moment the class of the GTEM field is the number 77 car. They've shown time and time again that they have the stones to really put the laps in when it counts. And they took home a fairly comfortable victory in the end by 46 seconds over the TF Sport Aston Martin, which again has been a revelation this season. Trevor,
mostly.
Did you catch much of the GTM race from trackside?
The big thing that I remember from the GTM field was at the start of the race and the first stint, and the Project One. It was a great first stint from, I believe, Patrick Lindsay.
Yep.
Made a really, really, really significant gap, and unfortunately, they couldn't use it, just like the Pro Porsche.
It was kind of weird how I think, this is a question I'm going to ask you to like recall back a bit, but did the weather change partway through the race? Did there all of a sudden get a lot of UV on the track surface, or did it become overcast and cloudy and cooler during the race? Because I feel like there was a lot of cars that seemed to fall away in the middle part of the race and then all of a sudden a lot more cars seemed to come up at that part of the race as well. Like we talked about the SMP racing cars dropping off. We talked about the Porsches dropping off. And you know, the Team Project One car as well. Was there something in the atmospheric conditions that really caused that you remember?
It was fluctuating throughout the day. The weather conditions in terms of temperature and in terms of cloud cover and the amount of sunlight hitting the track. I'm just looking at the weather report right now, and during the race the air temperature did climb significantly from the start of the race, about 3.5 degrees, and then plateaued, and track temperature as well was just a steady climb throughout the whole race session. So that is a good point to comment on, and how the teams, based on setup, managed to work with the changing conditions.
Yeah, there's just one more thing that towards the end of the race, both the 90 Aston Martin and the 56 had penalties for, I believe, pit lane infringements.
Yeah,
the gap at the front may be inflated artificially.
Yeah, so a stop and hold of 75 seconds, which basically handed Proton a pretty comprehensive victory in the end, and I did miss that before doing this session. So I'm sorry about that, guys.
Yeah, one more thing. Some drivers even went under 2 minutes during the race, didn't they?
Yeah, so there was two drivers who dropped it under 2 minutes in the GTM class, which is ridiculous in itself. So there was, I think it was Matteo Cairoli in the, I'm pretty sure it was Cairoli. I am just going to double check though, in the number 88 class car in the Proton Porsche, that's the second Proton Porsche. I am just going to double check that quickly while I'm here, and it was Cairoli who dipped it literally just under the 2 minute mark. But 59.8. But I think the most impressive part of the race was the number 77 car, Matt Campbell, in the middle stint. He was setting 2 minutes flat for an hour straight, and in that as well, he dropped it into a 59.6, which was just ridiculous in terms of what everyone else was doing at the time. Because you look at the other names around him at that time, you had Jörg Bergmeister, Giancarlo Fisichella, and Charlie Eastwood, I think, as well, all putting in 2 minute flats and kind of really sort of pushing at the edge of the laps, like just really trying to get it right towards that 2 minute mark. And he just blows him out of the water with a 59.6. It was just like, damn, that kid is good. And yeah, he made that gap when it counted, and that was, of course, in the midst of the other two cars getting the drive-through penalty and the 75 second stop and hold. And so, yeah, if you remove that 75 seconds, it probably would have been a TF Sport versus Team Project One battle at the end. I wonder how much the Dempsey Proton car backed off, if at all, towards the end of the race, knowing that they had that sort of gap. I guess we'll never know.
There should be, isn't there like timing data?
Yeah, there is timing data, but I don't have the expertise to go through it all. Trevor can do it.
Yeah.
He's got it set up right in front of me.
Yeah.
For doing this afternoon.
Good. I expect a full table of results of everything we talked about once we're done. Thanks, man. So to wrap up on the GCEM class, 77 Dempsey Proton car took home the win, their second win in succession after winning at Le Mans. TF Sport number 90, a really strong showing for them coming home in second place. Of course, they have Charlie Eastwood and Johnny Adam in that car now, as opposed to Ewan Hankey, which is a bit sad for Ewan Hankey, but that's the way of factory drivers, and that's how that goes. And then Team Project One taking home a really impressive third place. Jörg Burmeister, Patrick Lindsay, and what is his actual name? It's Edigio Perfetti. There we go.
Who is Norwegian?
Well, there you go. Yeah, so a really impressive result for them. Further afield, you had the 98 Aston Martin, 61 Clearwater Racing Ferrari, 86 Golf Racing Porsche, 70 MR Racing Ferrari, 88 Dempsey Proton Porsche, which I think ran into some early issues, and then the Spirit of Race Ferrari bringing home the rear 10 laps down. So that wraps up the 6 hours of Silverstone. So now that we've gone through that... Yeah, what were you?
There was a moment in GTM while we were talking about it. While Johnny Adam and Charlie Eastwood were incredibly good, there was this memorable moment with the 90 Aston Martin, which was my fantasy WC pick, where after a safety car restart, so the track went green, and Sally Hodge, who was in the car at the time, just kept on weaving and driving slowly as if it was safety car conditions. And I was like, this is my fantasy WC pick.
Yeah. Because they lost the lead at that point, didn't they? That's actually how they lost the lead. So
yeah, I was like, this is what I picked.
See, this is why you got to splash out and go for the 77 car in the fantasy. You got to go for that one that's going to confirm the win.
Yeah, I blew money on the 7.
Rookie mistake. Yeah. Anyway,
definitely a rookie mistake.
So that was the 6 hours of Silverstone. The next round of the WC is going to be the 6 hours of Fuji, which comes up on the weekend of October 6th, I believe.
It's the weekend of October 14th. It was going to be October 6th, I believe.
But it was going to be
October 21st, and then they moved it because Fernando wanted to go.
Yeah, so it's going to be weekend of October 14th. It is the same weekend as Petit Le Mans, which is a real pain in the butt. But that's the reality that we've got to deal with. So we'll do the best we can.
But because Fuji is the same weekend as Petit Le Mans, we have Timo Bernhard and Antonio Giovinazzi driving in Petit Le Mans,
amongst a few other people that a lot of the regular sports car guys may not have heard of, like Chaz Mostert, for example. Yeah, which is going to be real cool. And we've talked about that in Supercars Chat, if you want to have a listen to that. But basically, he's a young Australian supercars driver who's going to be racing at Petit Le Mans in Australia's favourite sports car, the Mate. So that'll be really cool. And there'll be more announcements, I think, in the upcoming month of new drivers getting plugged into the Petit Le Mans cars. So keep an eye out for that leading up to the event.
Wasn't Winkup also going to do Laguna Seca? Or did I get something wrong?
He was going to do Laguna Seca with Kenny Habul, but Kenny Habul withdrew that car. So I had a bit of a chat about the WEC calendar, provisional calendar for next year, or next season rather, in the Silverstone preview episode, the 17.5. Now, I wanted to open up the same opportunity to you guys, to Solheimus and to Trevor Vasaurus. So we touched on a few things in the discussion thread and what I did in that podcast. So the things that I really brought up was the clashing events between the Petit Le Mans and Fuji again, and then Bathurst 12 Hour and Sebring.
And Bathurst 12 Hour and Sao Paulo.
And Sao Paulo, sorry, you're correct. And then the change in race lengths, especially at Bahrain, which got extended versus Silverstone, which actually got shortened. Now, was there anything that you guys wanted to really have a shot at? Because if you do, this is the time you got to do it.
Yeah. In the meantime, it's also been revealed that if the provisional calendars hold, the 6 hours of Fuji is also going to clash with the Japanese Grand Prix.
Mm.
The one race, which might cause a problem with marshalling.
I think the problem with marshalling is overstated. They'll find marshals even if they have to import people. The thing is that really ticks me off is that you have maybe 4 weekends a year where they'll now allow international racing in Japan, because that's just, I don't know why they do it like that, but that's just the way that Japan is. And somehow you're not able to organize two tracks within 250 kilometers of each other to have them on different weekends for top level motor racing. It is just really, because what's going to happen is people are going to have to make a choice. They go to Fuji for the WEC, or do they go to Suzuka for the F1? And it's just real dumb, especially because they're in the same country. It's the same country on the same weekend. It's like, guys, please. Yeah. Please. Yeah. Please.
Yeah. They just carried Fuji over from this season, where it clashes with Petit Le Mans. So it's still going to clash with Petit Le Mans. But because the F1 calendar got extended, they've drawn out the season to leave holes for future expansion. The Japanese GP is now going to clash with the 6 hours of Fuji. Fantastic.
It's just so dumb. It's just so dumb.
Yeah.
Luckily, it's come to the fore since the WC calendar announcement that there is a little bit of wiggle room in some of the other events. You know, the Bathurst 12-hour might be able to get pushed back a little bit, or the Petit Le Mans may get pushed back a weekend as well. And remember, these are events in 2019 and 2020. So these are events that haven't explicitly been organized yet. So there is a little bit of wiggle room, which is all right. Trevor Soyce, did you have anything that you maybe wanted to add to this as well?
Not really. I'm as these series get bigger and bigger, they're going to clash. It's there's a limited number of weekends throughout the year.
Yeah.
The top classes are going to clash. But maybe looking at the durations of racing, is it right that one of the oldest motorsport trophies is awarded for the shortest race in the season with the RAC TT the tourist trophy for the what is now the 6 hours of Silverstone,
but then will become the 4 hours of Silverstone?
Just a quick thought. Do you think we could see WC and ELMS on track together at Silverstone, given that they were both 4 hours?
No way.
No way?
No. There's no way that you're going to have literally 60 cars on Silverstone at the same time.
With different pit lanes at the same time.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah. That's actually a good point. So there has been a lot of discussion about this with the Silverstone becoming a 4 hour event, you know, talking about why reduce one of the most prestigious events in the calendar to a 4 hour, why change, why move bigger other events to a longer race. And, you know, that's another thing as well, the tourist trophy, one of the longest standing trophies in motorsport being awarded for a 4 hour event. It does seem a little disingenuous or disintegral or whatever. There's a word there that I'm looking for that I can't find right now. You get what I mean. We've talked this. I talked it a little bit to death, I'll be honest. I did go over it a fair bit, but in some other media outlets. So Graham Goodwin on This Week in Sportscast, he actually said he absolutely doesn't see the problem with it being a 4 hour event, because 4 hours is a good length anyway. Like, ELMS races are quite good at 4 hours. We've seen that consistently, and we'll talk about that a bit more a little later on. It's also right in that perfect awkward length For whether or not you take that extra stop or you don't, for a lot of the classes in, well, the prototype classes in the WEC. So it could see an even more interesting race from that perspective. But as a as an attender of Silverstone, what do you think, Trevorsaurus?
Well, the time flew by. In person, it didn't drag on one bit. It was really a brilliant event for those whole 6 hours and the hype leading up to it before the green flag. I would be perfectly happy with it still being 6 hours and going, but you know, that's coming from someone who's been to the last two Le Mans 24s, staying up for the pretty much the whole thing. So, you know, I'm trying to put myself in the mind of a new fan that hasn't experienced these sorts of endurance races before. And the UK has got a big market of motorsport fans to potentially tap into, and to have a slightly shorter, more accessible race, then that might be a good thing for the series.
Yeah, I think I mentioned in the preview podcast I put together that, you know, as far as motorsport fans per capita, or at least motorsport interest per capita, Britain in general would have to be one of the largest areas simply because it's got such a huge engineering presence. And it kind of seeps through the culture. Is that something that you would agree with?
Definitely.
Yeah,
but
so,
I'm biased.
Yeah, you definitely are. Yeah, let's not forget about that. So there's a lot of questions around the future of WEC at the moment. Hopefully things become more stable once we get to this 2019-2020 season and we're able to sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel, because at the moment there's a lot of haze, and that's around the regulations, around the calendar, around the organization, around the competition. So we'll see what happens. We'll just see how it goes.
Just regarding the future and where we want to go, because we have, for example, I think in 2022, if both the Nürburgring 24 Hours and the 24 Hours of Le Mans keep their current schemes, they're going to clash directly, meaning the Nürburgring 24 Hours is going to be on at the same time as the Le Mans 24 Hours. Both of those races are very old. They're both very, very much steeped in tradition. The Nürburgring 24 Hours is always on the weekend of Ascension, which is six weeks after Easter, whereas Le Mans is always in the middle of June. In 2022, I think it's 2022, I'm not sure, those two are going to be the same weekend. And which tradition gives, if either? Like, this is something we know now, 3 years in advance, and if we are clever enough, if the powers that be are clever enough, they're going to start thinking about it now. And the general, I think even the general problem of the calendar as it is not thinking ahead far enough. Like, what do we not want to clash with as a certainty? And what can we clash with? Like, there's going to be clashes, as Trevor said. There's just clashes everywhere because there's just so much racing going on, rather.
Yeah.
And it's inevitable. But at the same time, there should be races that definitely don't clash, like
Le Mans and Nürburgring.
Le Mans and Nürburgring, or Petit Le Mans and everything else. Or
every sports cars, yeah.
Yeah, essentially the big races, sort of the 10, 12-hour races, they really they shouldn't clash with anything because the big and drivers are going to want to do them.
Yeah. Look, I think the most likely outcome for the planned Le Mans Nürburgring clash is that it's going to happen. I can't see the ACO moving Le Mans at all, ever, in its entire history of anything in the entire universe. And I don't think that the ADAC organizers are going to be all that intrigued with moving the Nürburgring 24 date unless they get properly persuaded in some way, shape, or form. So
properly persuaded,
yeah,
with some with a large amount of money,
possibly. or just, you know, outcry of millions of sports car fans on the internet. You know, one or the other.
Well, next year is going to be a good test to see if having them just 1 week apart is acceptable.
I think if it is, we may see that happen with the Nürburgring being the week before Le Mans. But of course, then you've got, like, at least they're close together. At least they're not, like, transatlantic.
I believe it's the other way around, but because there's plans potentially of going to both.
Okay.
But I'd prefer Le Mans to be afterwards.
Yeah. I would have two, personally.
There's also the issue of drivers, for example.
Yeah.
Most of the Porsche factory drivers do all four of the big races, I think.
Yep, and also the BMW guys as well have the opportunity. So it could be interesting. We'll see. Of course, we're not going to have all the answers because we're just dumb internet fans, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's four years in the future.
So exactly. So now we're going to say goodbye to Solheimus because we're going to be talking about ELMS, and he doesn't watch ELMS. Everyone shun him. Boo. Sean. So what have you learned from this episode so far?
I've learned that that I should watch ELMS.
Yes.
I plan to watch ELMS.
Good. You've learned the right lesson.
And I've learned that this is very fun and I want to do it again.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear that and I hope everyone enjoyed listening to you. Thank you very much, Solheimus.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Awesome. Let's get our teeth into some ELMS action. So ELMS was the curtain raiser for the WC at Silverstone, a 4-hour event. I do like the doubleheader for the ELMS and the WC. I think it's a really, really good, like, compressed weekend of motorsports. Did you actually get to see the ELMS on the Saturday, or did you only get to go to the Silverstone on the Sunday, Trevor?
I only went to the Sunday
event. Boo. Oh, that's fine. Okay.
Yep.
I, of course, was on the other side of the world, so I couldn't get to either. So, yeah, you got one up on me. I know, right? But I actually found the ELMS race a little more exciting than the WEC race on a personal level. Would you agree?
Well, when you put that many prototypes together, Something is gonna give.
Yeah, because what is it? It's 38 prototypes or something mental?
Something like that, yeah.
God, it's ridiculous. And so what did give? There was a few things that gived, and I thought one of them, there was a few that was really, really not good if you're a championship fan.
Well, Duquesne Engineering didn't have the best result, despite pushing up there and pretty much every previous race.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of them, especially after their result at A1 Ring, the Red Bull Ring, getting taken away from them. I was really hoping for them to bounce back through it, but a kind of disappointing-ish seventh place wasn't really what I was expecting from them. Furthermore, United Autosports had a shocking weekend. SMP Racing had a shocking weekend, and Race Engineering, one of the most exciting newer teams in the grid, also had a shocking weekend. It's just like, why do all the cool teams have problems?
There were some very, very interesting failures and problems. At the time, the 22 United Autosports, when that failed out on track with Phil Hansen diving out of the car as soon as he could, almost before the car had stopped rolling, was claimed that an emergency stop button was pushed somehow erroneously, and they would need, regardless of how many power cycles you do or to try and turn the car back on, you'd need a laptop with the right software to
factory
start
reset,
it. So it was completely, it was completely
apparently
gone.
It pulled one of the onboard fire extinguishers as well, which also basically shuts down every single system you can imagine.
Yeah.
Which was, really odd failure/issue to have. And man, United Autosports have just not been having the season that they would have wanted at all, especially after how strong they were last season. Because they're just really nowhere in the championships in any sense. Like, they're, what, 15th and 10th in their two championships at the moment, with their two cars at the moment. So really not good times for United Autosports. But I was more disappointed though with the race engineering car to get half an hour away from the finish and to end up, I think I recall them ending up in the gravel trap at the far end of farm, which is not where you want to be. It's really not where you want to be when you're a LMP2 car like that. And I think
I can't remember they were at the pointy end though.
Yeah, I feel like they were second or third on track as well, which makes it all the more depressing because they've been the surprise packet for me in terms of the championship this year and just in the competitiveness as well. So it was really, really disappointing to see them go out like that. But ELMS, why do you do this to me? But really, there were one or two other surprising results as well. And I think the most shocking is the second place result.
Especially considering the start of the race. If you watched just the first half an hour, 45 minutes of the race, you'd probably expect them to be in last place.
Yeah, definitely.
Based on a certain
Swede
gentleman in the car. I did another lap chart plot and based against another gentleman driver who happened to be starting on pole position. The data doesn't look good for Henrik Henry.
That's putting it mildly. So did you put this graph up on your sports car engineering blog as well?
No, I put it in the chat, but I'll redo it.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's
so
the
just
wrong
just for the people who aren't listening to us live, there's a graph comparing the lap time trends between Henrik Hedman and Julian Knauer. So Knauer has like a pretty general sort of the lap times are just kind of going out and they're pretty consistent. And then when they put the second stint on, the tires are a bit more worn out. It's it's a very nice straight line that's a slope of like maybe. What, 0.2 of a second per lap?
Yeah.
And then you look at Henrik Hedman's in comparison, and it starts 2 seconds further out, and then basically just goes straight up. it's just so much time lost in that first stint. But the thing is, though, I'm legitimately surprised at his pace in a P2 car. He seems to not be entirely crap, just a little crap.
Well, if you look at his first five laps, he's got a similar drop-off in performance based on tyre usage and, battling with potential cars around. But then after the fifth lap, coming round to the GT cars, lapping them for the first time, and then coming through the LMP3 field, it just goes to crap.
Yeah. It's just, he's fine on his own, but as soon as he gets around other cars, it is just kind of a little bit of a shit show. In saying that, though, having Ben Hanley and Nicolas Lapierre to carry him on was a masterstroke because they, as I said, ended up second place, which was a crazy good result, and I think it's the best result Dragon Speed has ever had in the ELMS, certainly this season from memory.
Yes. Well, in Paul Ricard, they didn't finish because of a crash. Then at Monza, they had a drive-through penalty. They had a drive-through penalty at the Red Bull Ring, didn't they? So
I'm pretty sure Hedman was just terrible at Red Bull Ring.
They did crash. Hedman did crash, mind, at Silverstone, but it was a much better result. And looking at the times that Lapierre was putting in, it was so quick. Yeah, I think he was, maybe I'd put the boat out saying that he was the fastest driver of the day.
Not over one lap. The fastest lap was John Aaron Byrne.
But based on his cloud of data points of following John Erik Verne very closely.
Yeah. So, okay, you've done quite a bit of work analysing the lap times for the LMP2 class at Silverstone in particular. So why have you taken on this sort of project?
So I was first looking at my interest was piqued by this race in particular before the LMP2 class of the day afterwards. And this was because of the car that started on pole position and the car that started in second place on the grid. And so on pole position was the Panis Barthez Ligier car, which was running Michelin tyres. And the car in second place was the 26G drive with Roman Rusinov in the car. And they're running Dunlops, and that's an Orica 07 chassis. And also Julien Canal was, I believe, in the Panis Barthez car. Now, there is a discrepancy in driver rating because Canal is a bronze and Rusinov is a gold now.
Yes.
But based on the first stints in the car, Canal put in some really, really good times and managed to get, I think, a 13-second lead at the start of the race.
Wow.
But then based on the tyre drop-off of the Michelin tyres, after the first pit stop, the lap times dropped away significantly such that Roman Rusinov just easily drove past.
So we mentioned it briefly talking about the WEC race. So you think that this might... So the Michelins in general just seem to degrade a bit more is the conclusion that you're making, right?
So the Michelin tyre started on pole position. So we can, you can think that of saying that on a one lap pace, this is also adding to the general consensus that the Michelin is really good on one lap pace. But then in race pace over a race distance, not so much.
But I'm looking at the results now, and the next two cars in the finishing list, the Dragon Speed number 21 and the IDEX Sport number 28 cars, both Oricas are on Michelin tyres. So how does that work when you've got, you know, Graf Racing, Rebellion Racing, Panis Barthez we mentioned, and that's in Ligier as well, let's not forget. Duquesne all on... Dunlops, sorry, Duquesne's not on Dunlops. United Autosports and those sort of guys on Dunlops. Why aren't they at the top of the grid?
Well, that comes into also, I think, something that I mentioned earlier in the application of Michelin tyres on Orica 07 chassis seem to be a much better package than the Michelin tyres on a Dallara or Ligier platform. Hmm.
Super interesting. So plotting
the numbers for the Orica-based Michelin tyres, they've got a much more consistent stint distribution of lap times.
That's fascinating. And you did a proper write-up for all this on your blog, which I'm going to keep plugging because I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, mainly that was on the WEC rather than ELMS. So I've only just been throwing these numbers together yesterday for ELMS, but more of the insight, you could say, is on the WEC race.
Cool. So if you haven't checked out the blog, do it because it's awesome. Sports Car Engineering. Again, I'm going to plug it. I'm going to keep plugging it. Do it because it's awesome. Results in LMP2 of the ELMS race. G-Drive just kind of drove away with it. Again, they won by a lap. I just cut and paste the same audio clip for the same result now. Just can't be stuff saying it anymore. But as we mentioned, Dragon Speed came second, and then it was IDEX Sport, the Paul Lafarge, Paul Lipchertin, and Memo Rojas car who came home third, only 8 seconds behind the Dragon Speed car as well. So it was a really cool battle towards the end of the race. And I've got to say, one of the coolest things about the ELMS for me is seeing a bunch of different teams up the front. like, but you know, removing G-Drive for a second, we've had Duquesne Engineering finish second at one point. We had Race Engineering, we've had S&P Racing, United Autosports, Graf has been up there, IDEX Sport and Dragon Speed are two teams we haven't really seen up there before. Panas Barthez has been a car that we've seen up the front a little bit. High Class Racing as well. They had a new livery this weekend. It looked friggin' awesome. So yeah, it is a really competitive series. So again, if you like Solheimers and you haven't seen it yet, just check it out because it's really, really good. Okay, just do it. Okay. Did that make the point clear enough, do you think?
Do it.
Yes. So moving on to LMP3 now. I've said this before about ELMS. LMP3 kind of gets lost in the noise sometimes, but it was still a pretty good race and a very, very tight competition between the United Autosports number 3 car and the, I can't even say the team name, Ekuri Ekros Nielsen car, number 7, with the few championship protagonists, that being the Ultimate Racing and the Eurosport car, I believe. Yeah, Euro International car and RLR M Sport, taking a bit of a back seat in this race. So RLR M Sport ended up in 6th, 360 Racing was in 4th, and the Euro International car was down in 10th. So we really saw a vast variety in LMP3 coming up to the front. I'm going to be honest, I can't really remember too much of the LMP3 race besides the battle for the lead. Is that bad?
To be honest, I'm in the same boat.
Yeah. LMP3 is good, but it does kind of just get lost in the noise, especially considering the noise in the GTE class, which was phenomenal. Again, absolutely again. The story of the GTE class was really, really cool. It kind of came down to a three-way fight for the lead with none of the cars next to each other in the last stint. It was kind of nuts. So what happened was the JMW Motorsport car and the Spirit of Race car, the two Ferraris, were leading the race towards the end. However, both of them were given penalties for, I'm trying to remember what it was for. They were both given 10 second penalties for track limits. Yeah, that was right. Now, the Proton car, the number 88. Thank you for pulling me up on these. Number 88 That's car right. was around that 10 or 11 second point behind as well. So what we ended up having was a three-way battle for the lead in which the Proton Porsche was trying to chase as hard as they could to catch up to the JMW Motorsport Ferrari, who was trying to pass the Spirit of Race Ferrari for the lead. But it wasn't actually the lead, because at that point the two cars were within 10 seconds of the 88 Porsche that was chasing them, and it ended up with a pass, I think, on the penultimate lap for the lead by JMW Motorsport to take the lead on track. And then they had to try and fight to drag the gap out to more than 10 seconds. And as it happened, in the final throes of the race, the Proton Porsche went wide at the last corner, crossed the line in third position, 10.126 seconds behind the JMW Motorsport. So after that 10 seconds was applied, it was a 0.126 second gap at the end of the GTE race. It was really, really cool. And the drama around that was such an awesome way to experience the end of the race. It was awesome. I thought it was awesome.
I loved following along with the commentators, you know, Johnny Palmer and GG. It was really good because we were all bumbling through trying to understand what was going on without seeing it, you know, visually on screen. There were no visualizations saying where they would be based on the penalty being applied. They just had a timing screen. We just had a timing screen, and then just trying to do the maths as it happened. And then that suspense, as are they going to do it? Are they going to do it? The JMW car passed the Spirit of Race and then had to get their own gap because the Proton car was kind of taking it easy because the gap was about 8 seconds. They could kind of manage it. And then suddenly, on the last lap, it all sort of
came
exploded
out of the
watch,
and went. Yeah. It was really cool. It was like a rally, but on an endurance racing track. So yeah, that was the story of GTE, and it was really, really cool. JMW taking the win on their home soil, basically. I think that's their third Silverstone in a row that they've won.
Or maybe I haven't been following ELMS for long enough to say for sure.
People, follow ELMS. It's so good. So they took the win ahead of the... so the 66 car took the win ahead of the 88 car, who came second by 0.126, as we mentioned. And they led home the 55 car in third, and then the 77 car in fourth, almost a lap, half a lap down. And then the 86 car, which just kind of ruins the flow of double numbers, came home fifth, which I guess. Golf Racing, that was, yeah, a double whammy for Golf Racing, competing in both the ELMS and WEC and not really performing in either. Let's just put it out there. I'm sorry. I'm not actually sorry. Then the Crone Racing car came home sixth, and the EBI Motors car were not classified because they didn't complete the last lap. Now, I'm not sure why, but they did complete 4 hours, but they did not complete the last lap.
Interesting.
I need to go back and figure out why that was, actually. That's really weird, because I would have thought that they would have done that. I mean, they were in last place. So,
they did 112 laps alongside the Crone Racing car, but they did it more than a minute faster than... So they completed the same amount of distance as the Crone Racing car, but in a faster time. But then, as you're saying, then the last lap is the one that counts.
Yeah, because they didn't actually cross the line again. And the leader didn't cross the line until a minute after the EBI Motors crossed the line. I wonder if they ran out of fuel.
Or, this is completely wild speculation, whether they knew that the line was being measured in a different place to the WEC, because they're using the different pit lane.
Oh, of course.
That would be funny if they went into the wrong, like, paddock or something.
Yeah, if they crossed the line and then went straight into their pit bay. Oh, I wonder if that's what's happened. Oh, no.
That would be funny.
That would be so bad. Someone's going to find out. Someone out there knows. Someone's going to find out. We'll sort it out. But it does leave the championships... in a pretty interesting position for a few of them. So, of course, in LMP2, G-Drive's just kind of run away with it. They're a full race ahead of the field, you know, minus 1 point at this stage of the season. Actually, no, they are over a full race ahead of the field. But with that zero for Race Engineering, they get dragged all the way back to the field. They are now only 3 points ahead of IDEX Sport, who have been putting in some decent results to pull up third place, and now Dragon Speed and TDS are the next two cars just over 10 points behind. Moving to GTE, it is a bit of a proton show at the moment, but JMW Motorsport, with that win, have closed the gap massively. And of course, JMW recovering from a zero at the the Red Bull Ring. I made that mistake twice now, sorry. It's going to be an interesting race, and we've got 6 rounds this year, so we've still got a round at Spa-Francorchamps and then a round at Portimao, which will be really cool, I think, as a finale. Algarve is just a fantastic track, in my opinion. I'd love to see more racing at Algarve, and I'd like to see more racing at Brno, if they could do that. ELMS to Brno, anyone? ELMS to Brno?
Well, that would be good.
That would be real good. It's one of my favorite tracks, actually. I think that wraps everything up. Did you have anything you wanted to add to the ELMS at all?
No, just congratulating the series on having some great broadcasting quality and commentary.
Mm.
That has to be said.
Really does help wrap you into it as well. And yeah, I got to say, in general, the ELMS has been a breath of fresh air this season because there's just no politics in ELMS. I mean, besides G-Drive, but like, screw those guys. So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you very much for listening. The next ELMS round is at Spa-Francorchamps, and that comes up later this month. I think it's the 29th of September is the 23rd, sorry. So a lot closer than I was expecting. So I think it's only 3 weeks away, in fact. Yes, it is. 2 weeks, in fact. So we'll have sports car racing again very shortly. In the meantime, we will be having our Endurance Chat Unpopular Opinion special, and here's Chris to tell you a bit more about that. Pew!
You've had your say, now it's our turn. The Endurance Chat Unpopular Opinion special, where we will be taking your ideas and deciding who's got the best opinion, who's just plain wrong, and hopefully having some fun along the way. We'll get this out in the next couple of weeks, so if you have got your ideas in, get them in now. Otherwise, just keep an ear out. It promises to be a great show.
And once more, if you haven't heard about that, check out the thread. It's linked in the Tuesdays at Turtle Rouge thread on the subreddit. And if you want to get something in for that, please do. Apparently, you can win something because it's a competition. I didn't know that. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to disclose that, but it's getting disclosed now. And it should be a lot of fun. I'm very keen to have a go at a few of these opinions that people have posted already. Thank you very much for joining me, Trevor Vasaurus.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much, Solheimus, for coming along. I hope you really enjoyed it, and we'll definitely have you on for another episode at another point in time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much for listening. Peace out. Gazoo.
Gazoo.